continue with the second part. So yeah, I would like to continue with the mobile IP protocol as an example for a security relevant protocol. The situation is, of course, that we increasingly have mobile computing nodes, and one obvious example is laptops, but also other kinds of computers. And secondly, increasingly wireless networks such as GPRS, UMTS, and so on. And therefore, there's the need to somehow be able to move these computers from one link, from one communication link to another one, and if possible, without having to change the IP address. And the reason why one doesn't want to change the IP address is firstly, that you don't, well, otherwise you would have to restart the communication with the new address, and this would not be so good if you want to do things such as voice over IP or video streaming or things like that, where you really want to have a communication without an interruption. And secondly, with the new IPv6 V6 protocol, where the idea is that really everything in the world can have its own IP address. The idea should be that the IP address is really fixed to this thing, and you don't have to change it anymore at all. And but yeah, now the situation is, how can you implement this in a situation where the network nodes may actually move around the network, and where in the next moment you suddenly, the communication link may go to a different node in the system. And the idea here is to use two kinds of addresses for each node in the system, or at least for the mobile nodes. Firstly, the home address, which actually remains fixed throughout the execution of the system, and secondly, the care of address, which is the current address at the current location of the mobile node. And so this is the situation in principle. You have an IP network such as the internet, you have a home network where you start from, and where the mobile node is usually at home, and then you have a mobile node which travels across the IP network and may at some point be at a foreign network, maybe at a hotel or GPRS network, and then you still want to be reachable by other communication partners, and you also want to be able to communicate with the internet still. And the way this works in principle is that whoever wants to reach you from the internet still contacts your home address and you, with your home agent in your home network, and from there the communication is then relayed to the care of IP address at the mobile node where it currently resides. And then in order to speed up the communication, I mean, of course, in principle you could always go through the home agent, but this may not be the most efficient thing, especially if the mobile node is sort of at the other end of the world and wants to communicate with some node near there. Then it's not really efficient to always go through the home node. And therefore, people thought of this triangular routing mechanism, where the mobile node can then communicate with the IP node and the IP network directly, and then from then on, there could be a direct communication. And this is using the so-called binding update mechanisms. And so there's a new communication binding performed by this binding update. But the point is that this mechanism is quite security critical, because as before, you may always have some kind of adversary sitting on the internet and trying to launch some kind of man-in-the-middle attack, which is still possible on the internet in principle, and which is even more easily possible in a wireless network, because there the communication is even less protected, because everyone who is within the reach of the radio waves can, of course, receive the radio waves, whereas on the internet you actually need to have physical access to the communication links. So in a wireless network, you have to be even more concerned with such kind of attacks, and in particular with respect to this binding update between the mobile node and the application server in the IP network. You have the threat that the adversary also tries to attack this binding update and tries to make this kind of masquerading attack, where the application server then thinks that the adversary is actually the mobile node, similar to the attack that I explained earlier. And so within the development of this mobile IP protocol, which is by now pretty much has reached a rather stable point of development, although with respect to security there are still some proposals being discussed, but in principle it's really rather stable now, and the main security mechanism which is supposed to be used now to ensure the security of this mobile IP protocol is the so-called routing-based authentication. There the idea is, firstly, the goal is that the mobile IP protocol should enforce a communication which is as secure as in the usual wired network. So the goal is not to be more secure than that. This is important to note. Keeping that in mind, the mechanism works like this. So firstly, the foreign network sends a secret key to the home agent, as in the situation on the previous slide, through a route which is hopefully secure and which could be tried to be secured using encryption. And then secondly, the home agent forwards this key to the mobile node through a secure tunnel which should be set up between the home agent and the mobile node from throughout the execution of the mobile node, and then the mobile node can use this secret key to authenticate the binding update to the foreign network. And that way, if we assume that the adversary does not get hold of the secret key, the adversary is not able to forge this binding update. But of course this relies on the fact that the connection between the foreign network and the home agent is made secure. And in that sense, mobile IP is no more secure than the wired underlying network between the foreign network and the home agent. So much about the mobile IP protocols. This is the sort of current state of the art there, how the security is to be implemented in this protocol. Now I would like to continue with some embedded application security example, and this is an example which we actually considered in industrial projects with the TU Munich, within a project. And here we considered a smart card based electronic purse, the so-called common electronic purse specifications. This is a globally interoperable standard developed by Visa International and other companies, which together have a market share of 90% of the market. And the goal is to have a standard which is internationally interoperable. Whereas so far, most of these electronic birth schemes were only worked on a national level. And the goal is to be able to use the electronic birth also abroad. And in general, of course, the motivation for using smart cards is that this way you can authenticate single transactions as opposed to the situation with credit cards, where you use the same credit card number for every transaction, meaning that if the adversary gets hold of your credit card number, he can use it to perform another transaction without you wanting him to do that. And this is not possible with smart cards because the authentication is bound to the single transaction. And actually here I don't want to have invasion. It gets a bit annoying if you have this single line blending in the slides. I should get rid of that some way. Anyway, so this with these electronic purses within the project, the goal was to analyze the specification for possible security weaknesses, because as I pointed out, it's really not easy to design the security protocols correctly. And more specifically, we focused on one of the main parts of the specification, namely the load protocol, where the goal is, there are different variations on that, but the one that we focused on is the unlinked cache-based load transaction, where the owner of the card should be able to insert it in a load machine and also insert some cache in the loading machine, and thereby load the electronic purse. And the load device makes use of the so-called load security application module, where the secure data processing and encryption is supposed to be performed. And where also the transaction data is being logged in order to analyze this after the transaction. So the point why the logging data is very important here is that there is no direct communication channel, secure communication channel between the card holder and the card, because with most usual smart cards, there is no input-output interface to the user. So it's not possible to, of course there are some specific smart cards where you actually have some little keyboard or maybe some kind of display, but with the usual smart cards, this is not the case. And therefore, the user who uses the smart card in some kind of terminal always has to trust the terminal with respect to the communication that is done between the card holder and the smart card. And unfortunately, terminals are not always trustworthy. And this is not like being more paranoid than necessary. There are actual examples also which happened here in Munich a couple of years ago, where people set up fake cash machine terminals. And this can always happen also with these kind of smart cards and electronic purses. So the people simply put up a cash machine or put up some kind of thing which looked like a cash machine, and people then the users put in their cash account card, and also of course typed in the PIN number, and then the card was gone for some reason. The user maybe didn't really suspect anything and just thought, okay, the machine is broken, I will come back tomorrow, or after the weekend rather. But by then, of course, the thief will already have gone with the card and with the PIN number and will already have withdrawn some money from the card. So, this is the usual kind of attack, and of course, this can also happen with this kind of smart card-based electronic purses, and that's why the transaction mechanism, the transaction logging is so important. And this is why, because then at least in with retrospective, you can see whether there was actually this kind of attack, and the customer is not at his fault, and then maybe the company would pay up for the damage or whatever. Or you can see whether the customer simply invented this that this happened, and therefore you use this kind of, you need this kind of secure logging mechanism which logs the transaction data to see whether the transaction actually took place. And this is sort of the specification of this part of the protocol. Again, I'm not going to explain it in detail here now, but the point is just that there are different components in the system, and that there are different pieces of data which are supposed to satisfy certain security requirements, such as secrecy and integrity, which I already mentioned earlier. And these are again connected by communication links, which are also not trustworthy. And the point is then that what you do in this kind of security analysis is firstly to think about the security threat model. You have to consider who could be the possible adversary, what kind of strength this adversary would have. So here we assume that the smart cards are actually tamper resistant, because it's this is the usual assumption on smart cards, and with this kind of attackers, you don't assume that they have a large laboratory where they could try to physically attack the cards. And then it's still possible that the communication links can be intercepted. And there may be different kinds of stakeholders in the system who may try to attack certain security requirements. And the point is that since this is supposed to be a globally interoperable system, you may not even trust the different kind of card issuers or the different kinds of load acquirers, because they may be at the other end of the world and may be controlled by the mafia or whatever, and you may not be able to do any legal transactions against them, because they may simply not be reachable. So this also may sound a bit paranoid, but the point is that there are examples in practice where actually different companies try to cheat on each other. So a famous example from the book by Ross Anderson on security engineering, there used to be, or there are actually in London, different private companies controlling the metro network, and at some point it turned out that they actually betrayed each other in the way that the point is that one passenger usually enters the network at the part which is owned by a certain private company, and may go some way along the metro and may leave the metro at some other point which is owned by a different company. And these different companies try to betray each other by forging the actual route which the passengers took, and thereby claiming that they actually took a longer portion of the journey in their own network. And this actually happened in reality. This is just an example that within such a system, one card issuer cannot even trust the other card issuers, which sounds paranoid, but that's the situation. And that's also why this kind of system had to be designed securely. And now, one of the security requirements we focused on was this load acquirer security, and this means now that the situation is, of course, if the load acquirer who has this load machine gets the cash from the cardholder, then the cash has to be later forwarded to the card issuer, because then the card issuer in the next step has to forward the money to the merchant who sold some kind of good using the smart card. And for this, of course, you have to somehow be able to prove that the load acquirer actually received this kind of money. And this is sort of captured by this kind of security requirement, that it's actually possible to prove at a certain point of time that the load acquirer got some certain amount of money from the cardholder. And this is what we try to analyze the system specification with. And Yeah, you can formulate this in more technical detail when you look at the technical specification, and this refers to a certain cryptographic data which is used in the specification, so I don't actually want to explain in detail here, but just mention that this is a quote from the actual specification where they claim that a certain digital signature provides a certain guarantee that actually the loan acquirer owes some sort of money to the card issuer. And we now wanted to make sure that this statement is actually true. And it actually turned out that when we analyzed the UML specification, which we constructed from the textual specification given in their documents, that this is actually not true. This statement which was given in the specification. And in fact, this requirement is not provided by this digital signature. And here the reason is not so complicated to see actually. The point was simply that they used to create this digital signature, they used a symmetric signature key shared between the loan acquirer and the card issuer. And the reason for using a symmetric key is of course that firstly the loan acquirer can sign the transaction data, and secondly the bank issuer can verify this signature because they both have the same key. And that was sort of the goal of using a symmetric algorithm here. But of course the problem is that if it's shared between the loan acquirer and the bank issuer, then of course the bank issuer is also able to construct the signature himself. And therefore it's not a real proof because the loan acquirer can always claim, if there was some kind of dispute later, can always claim that the bank issuer actually constructed the signature themselves, and therefore again the bank issuer cannot use this as a proof because there actually would be the possibility. And therefore, the statement which was given in the specification is simply wrong. Which does not mean that the specification on the whole is now insecure, absolutely, but it only means that now, in fact, the loan acquirer and the bank issuer have to trust each other, because otherwise they may end up in court and they may have no technical means to prove that they are actually right. This is sort of the outcome of this analysis. And as an example for some kind of embedded security application where actually something went wrong. And now I want to again go a bit deeper in the level of abstraction here. So far I mainly talked about the design level. And now I would like to say a little bit more about the actual programming part, because that's also where security weaknesses can be introduced. And I start with maybe the most well-known kind of vulnerability, which we know. That's the so-called buffer overflow weakness. And this is, probably most people have already heard of this kind of weakness because that's the cause of most security flaws that are being publicized almost every day, at least on a very regular basis. As the name already indicates, this vulnerability relies on the fact that certain programming languages such as C, for example, don't have an inbuilt mechanism which would check that certain allocated space of memory is not exceeded by a value which is written into this part of the memory at runtime. And because this is not usually checked, it can happen that a certain part of memory is allocated, and during runtime, in fact, there's more data being written into this part of memory, and thereby, if the adversary actually applies some deep technical sophistication, there is the possibility that this way, for example, an adversary is able to execute arbitrary code on the host machine. It may even have super user rights by doing this. And of course, one may wonder how this is possible, and the main idea how you can exploit this kind of buffer overflow vulnerability is by using this sort of the so-called stack smashing attack. And I will, in the next couple of slides, I will shortly explain how in principle this works. So firstly, a little bit of background about the stack which makes this this attack possible. So firstly, it's of course a portion of the address space of a process which is supposed to, for example, provide storage for local variables, and also sort of scratch pad area whenever the process needs temporary storage. And so what is stored there, for example, is some kind of, also some kind of bookkeeping information for the function calls that are made to the current process. For example, parameters are stored there that won't fit into the registers, and also save values from the registers. And finally, and importantly, the address from which the function was called. And this is really the main problem here. Because all of this is sort of more or less lumped together on the stack, and there's now the threat that if there's not sufficiently memory allocated for certain variables, and because the variables and the return addresses actually sit side by side on the stack, it may happen that when the variables are assigned a piece of information which exceeds their actual memory bounds, that this is actually being written into the space where the return address is supposed to be stored. And even beyond that, there may then also be some attack code introduced. So the idea is that the attacker somehow provides some kind of input string to the system, maybe through some kind of human input-output interface, or maybe some kind of other input-output interface of the current system. And assuming that the input is not checked with respect to the length, the maximal length that is allocated to the relevant local variables which are stored on the stack, if this is not checked, then it can happen that it is being overwritten. Firstly, the return addresses, and as I said, secondly, also that there's some attack code also introduced into the system. And if this is done correctly, then the return address will now point to the attack code instead of pointing to the function which actually called the current process. So after the process is done with its execution, it will then jump to the attack code, and then you, depending on the writes with which the current process is being executed, the adversary may even have super user rights on the system. Depending on, if for example, if the current process is executed with super user rights. And this is one of the reasons why one should, as far as possible, make sure that programs are only executed with the least amount of privileges that are necessary for them to function correctly. So one should avoid letting all kinds of programs being executed in superuser mode, because then if this kind of attack is possible, the adversary automatically gets access to the super mode, user mode as well. And well, just a very short example. Well, here in this fragment of the program, firstly an array line is allocated on the stack. If then get operation is provided with more than the allocated space, this will the space will be exceeded, and there may be some data written on the return address and also some attack code, and as I explained on the previous slide.
One question. Mm-hmm. How do you get your code into the system? I mean, there
yeah,
must be on this address your code.
For example, I mean, the code, you include this with the same kind of input string, the situation, the assumption is that the program has some kind of input, expects some kind of input string, and the adversary sends the input, which is firstly longer than expected, and then secondly includes firstly a different return address, and secondly the attack code, all of that in one string. And of course this is not entirely trivial to do, because you have to have some certain kind of knowledge about the architecture of the system, and you need to do some kind of trying around to actually get this to work correctly. So if the vulnerability is there in principle, it doesn't mean that it is easy to exploit it, but the possibility is there, and that's why one should probably worry about that. Yes, I'm going to mention this on this slide here. I mean, there are now, in fact, standard ways of preventing these kind of problems, but for some reason, people are not using them. And this for quite some time now. I mean, yeah, the problem of buffer overflows in principle is solved for quite a long time now. In principle, there exist mechanisms, that's really true, but for some reason people don't use them. Nobody knows why, because they are not aware of the problem, or it's too much effort, I don't know. And that's why it's still one of the most prominent vulnerabilities. This I actually sort of mentioned already, so we have a particular problem if the program is executed as user, or if you have this set UID permissions. This I mentioned. Yeah, and in fact now, how can you prevent this? Firstly, of course, you should validate all input with respect to the expected length, so perform bounds checking. And as I said already, let programs execute at lowest necessary privilege levels. And then, as mentioned also, there are actually safer alternatives, for example, within C, which you can use instead of these functions which do not check the bounds. And then there are also some more sophisticated tools which you can also use, which I will explain in the next slide. Here I maybe just want to mention that this input validation thing is not just an important thing to consider if you write C programs, but also in other situations such as web application security. And this is the sort of current hype, one could say, almost the sort of cross-site scripting attacks and so on. And these also rely on the fact that user input is not sufficiently validated. So, for example, you sometimes have web formulas where the users can enter some kind of, for example, a search phrase, which will then be searched on the local web server, and then the search term will be given back with some kind of result. And sometimes there also no input validation is being done, which allows the user to include, for example, HTML tag as their search string, and thereby get out some funny results and even attack the system that way. So validating input, all input which comes from untrusted part of the system, particularly from the users, is very important in all kinds of situations. But as we can see, every day almost, it's not being done in a sufficient way. And now I just want to mention some more sophisticated tools which you can also use in this situation of C programs. So for example, there's this so-called stack guard, which is a patch for the GCC compiler, which enables the executed code to detect such an attack, which aims to change the return address. And whatever happens, the program will fail in the safe state, which is always better than running on and maybe allowing some kind of attack. You do have a moderate performance penalty there, but the advantage is that no modification in source code is necessary. So this applies also to code which already exists. With the new code, of course, you should follow the advice given on the previous slide, but with the code which you already have, you usually don't want to rewrite the whole thing by using these more secure functions, and then you can use these kind of tools. And there are two kinds of functions within the StackGuard tool. Firstly, using so-called canary words, which prevents this modification of the return address by writing random data between the local variables and the return address and checking that this data is not being altered, and thereby making sure that the return address has not been changed. And the second approach within this tool is the sort of memguard approach, where the memory page which stores the return address is made read-only, which is more secure than using this canary words, but it has the disadvantage that whenever you want to write two variables written on the same memory page, you sort of have to emulate them, and that way the program gets slower, so you do have some performance penalty there. And second kind of tools to prevent this kind of problem is a Linux kernel patch to make the stack non-executable, which has the advantage that there's no performance penalty, but in principle, buffer overflow attacks may still be possible. Only the stack itself cannot be executed, but you can still change the return addresses. And then another GCC patch is there, which automatically performs the array bounds checking, which is still more secure, but there you actually have a significant performance penalty. And of course, quite different advice would be that if you're not, if you don't have to use C for some reason, then it's probably still more secure to use some kind of type-safe language, which does this bound checking automatically, and Java is an example for that. But of course, it's not always possible to use other kind of programming languages. And in that case, you can use the methods and the tools which I mentioned.
One question.
Only
a question from the compiler, for example, from the C compiler. I mean, you could include this check also in the compiler, and then
Yes, for example, by using this GCC patch, for example. But of course, the problem is that because this array bounds checking is performed at runtime, and it cannot be performed at compile time usually, you have to do this every time the value is assigned to the variable on the stack, and this, of course, takes time. Thereby, you have this performance penalty. And
so a new C++ compiler, there's a switch for that you can check some array bound rules. Usually, so for Well, each compiler you can provide like hook function. It's your own code, which is executed when a new function is entered and when a function is left again. So then you can do whatever you want, verify anything or do some profiling or whatever. That is up to you, but usually you have some performance loss. And I mean, but what you can do usually, because so other tools like bounce checker or verify, you don't need to, like instrumentation, you don't need to compile all your object modules with bounce checking. So maybe you just compile the object modules which are dangerous with bounce checking, and well, and the object modules where you do a lot of computation but which are not so dangerous, there you compile without, or there's always some, you can find a way. But at least, so I think before delivery, so each program should be checked, all the modules should be checked at least one time, something like verify or bounce check or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, so I think this talk is supposed to go until 6, right? Or what was the intention? So I should finish shortly, I think. So just to wrap up some bit more high-level view on the system, so on this problem of designing security-critical systems. So far I mentioned certain problems and certain techniques which you can use to deal with the problems, and now I would like to just shortly mention the more general approach to trying to deal with the different kinds of problems. So firstly, I mentioned already the real reason why all these problems occur in practice is that you always have this this cost issue, and so far it has actually been unfortunately the seemingly most commercially successful strategy to perform this banana strategy by firstly distributing the software in some state of readiness, and then letting it ride at the customer and sending them patch after patch which sort of corrects the flaws which come up later. And of course there has been actually a lot of work in the academic community to deal with the problem, for example under the label of formal methods. Unfortunately these have turned out to be rather expensive to use, at least in the way they were traditionally sold to industry in a way, because it usually meant that people had to be trained in some sort of logical notation, and they had to construct formal specifications whenever they wanted to use this. And now, just to mention very quickly this approach of using UML for constructing secure systems, which we have been looking at this research group at the TU Munich. The idea is to use artifacts which are being constructed within the software development process anyhow. For example, this could be UML specifications if they are used already, or this could also be source code which is being programmed, and then use tools which can analyze the models or the source code for security vulnerabilities before it is actually executed in some sort of static time or compile time analysis. And then you can also do a sort of specific security testing in order to make sure that the actual implementation is then secure. And the general idea is that you want to use models as a link between the requirements and the code, and thereby make sure that the systems are secure by design. And the reason why one of the approaches we use here is based on UML is simply that this is the notation which currently is used mostly in industry, wherever people use some sort of modeling notation at all. And the goal is now that if you consider this model level, that you use these models to include the security requirements such as secrecy, integrity, and so on within the UML specification, and you also include some kind of adversary threat model which arises from the physical infrastructure of the system, such as internet links and so on, and then you have some automated tool support which allows you to automatically analyze the specification with respect to the threat model which arises from the UML specification. And these security requirements can be included in the specification by using so-called stereotypes, which are labels that can be attached to the various diagrams in a unified modeling language specification. And they have associated constraints which can be analyzed automatically using automatic tool support. And one of the applications I showed already, this was this electronic birth specification, where we actually use this UML-based method together with the associated tool support in order to detect this security vulnerability which I explained. But there are also different kinds of applications which we are currently doing in various projects. And yeah, I don't actually have the time now to expand this in detail here, but as I said already, it's also possible to base a sort of automated testing process on the UML specifications, and thereby firstly make sure that the implementation conforms to the specification, and secondly also to do some more specific security testing with respect to the security requirements to make sure that there are no security flaws in the implementation. And while there are some tool support which is actually available for free over a web interface at the which is accessible at the URL which is given in the end of the slides. So the way this works is that a developer can construct a UML model using one of the industrial UML tools, upload it to our analysis tool, and there we have different kinds of analysis engines which analyze the model for security requirements, and then the developer gets back firstly a text report which may highlight certain vulnerabilities, and also modified UML models where the vulnerabilities are pointed out and where there may be some suggestions for improvement. Yeah, and this is the end of the talk, so some further resources on, well, mostly the last couple of slides where I mentioned this UML-based approach. There's a book coming out in 2 weeks, and there are also other kinds of tutorials also in near here in the next couple of weeks, at least one within Germany, sort of near here, or Austria, which give a bit more detail about this UML-based approach. And information, well, you can find on this URL, which is also included in the handouts. And, well, to finish, I can just say that if we are as the chair of the software systems engineering at Munich, we are always interested in collaboration also, so if you have some kind of interesting problem which you may think that some academic security researcher could usefully think about using whatever kinds of tools or methods, then you can just let me know, and we're always happy into entering some kind of collaboration. So thank you much for your interest and your patience. I think I run over a couple of minutes, but anyway, I hope that's not a problem. Okay. Any questions still?
Questions still? For me, was a good mixture of general statements like difference in safety and security, or quantify asymmetric and symmetric algorithms, but on the other hand, very detailed explanations like the buffer overflows induced by exploit. So mm-hmm. really enjoy that.
Okay.
So there are no questions. Everything, everybody feels safe and secure. But so then, that's the end. Just from, so Michael, say a few words. So just from my point of view, thank you very much for staying with GRIP curriculum until the end. So it was a pleasure to meet you, to meet all of you, and I hope you enjoyed it, at least some of you.